Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome a really great co-host today, one of our great UNC Family Medicine residents, Dr. Laura Gay. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laura and I worked together at the UNC Family Medicine Center on the same side, seeing patients for a couple of years now. And I just assumed, since I see you all the time, that you had been a co-host on the show today, but this is your first time.
It is. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we're really excited to have you here. And, you know, we're going to be talking with Rabbi Mark Borowitz, a recovering alcoholic and ex-con who now serves as senior rabbi and co-director of the Lane Breslow Institute at Beit Tshuva, about his story about faith and spirituality's role in recovery. This seems like an amazing conversation I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be interesting to see his story and his perspective on things.
Yeah, it's not often that we get a recovering alcoholic and ex-con who now is a senior rabbi. I haven't heard that one before, but I'm really looking forward to this. First, we've got some interesting research that matters. And let's just dive right in to our very first article, Laura. And it's about using large data sets to investigate what's happening with patients who may show up late to a visit. What's this research about?
Yeah, so it's actually done at UNC Children's. They were looking at factors that cause not only for the clinic appointments to be running late, but really why patients are running late as well. It seems like what they found was, you know, basic things, kind of common sense. You know, the biggest predictor of being late for a patient is actually that they had been late to previous appointments. So they kind of looked at, you know, things that they could kind of help the family with, so try to help them get a little bit more on time.
They reviewed 65,000 clinic visits over 2 years. And things that, you know, is it matter how far away you have to travel to the doctor's office, which type of doctor, maybe the primary care versus the specialist day of the week. And I found it was kind of interesting that appointments on Mondays and Tuesdays were the hardest to families to get to on time. I know my household, particularly when I had kids, Monday was a difficult day because you're really, really struggling to get kids to school and everything else. So if it's your own appointment or even the kids' appointment, it may be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But I also wondered, you know, what were their solutions? Because when their solution was, well, they're going to work backwards and go through each step and then try to figure it out. So maybe, you know, the patients who are late are the ones who usually come late. So then talking with them beforehand about, well, you know, why are you coming late? And I thought, well, that's, I guess, useful, but it may be like you got to do something about it. If it's like, I need a place for childcare, are you going to put childcare in the doctor's office?
Well, there's talk of that.
Yeah, and maybe that's what we need to do and be able to offer to make it so that people can get to appointments on time, and also explain why that's important. You know, a lot of times when my patients come 5 or 10 minutes late, 20 minutes late, I'll still see them because I know, again, that I do come late sometimes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the issue is when one patient's late, it just has the domino effect, and then it makes it late for every single other patient.
That's a problem for everyone.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. This is really a little scary, but it's about if you witness fear. So you see someone else going through something traumatic and you witness it, does that alter how you think? Does that cause really significant problems in you watching it, what might be called post-traumatic stress disorder that you experience from someone else's fear?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, usually we think about PTSD with a threat to your own life and when you are not necessarily experiencing the threat to somebody else's life. So it is an interesting study that looks at that. And in an age where we're, you know, seeing and experiencing things through the internet and through the news stations and things like that, it's quite scary.
Yeah, this was in the journal Neuropsychopharmacology, a mouthful to say, but they looked at actually rodents, and I thought this was interesting, who witnessed stress in their counterparts. And they saw that there were changes in the brain, the prefrontal cortex. This was done up at Virginia Tech. And it just simply suggests that observational fear changes the blood flow of the brain. Really interesting, but also suggests maybe we should be really more sensitive to how people are watching TV in our age of Facebook and YouTube and all these videos.
I don't know the solution for it, but it is something to be mindful of for sure.
Yeah, all kinds of social cues certainly to be worthwhile being aware of. Our next research that matters, Laura, is about morning sickness, nausea and vomiting in earlier pregnancy, and what one does about it, and do the drugs work or not work? What's this all about?
Yeah, so this article is about a medication called Diclegis. It's a commonly used medication for the nausea that happens with early pregnancy in that first trimester. It's a pretty old medication. It's been around since the 1970s, and actually, what this latest data is showing that is that Diclegis might not work as well as we think it has in the past. And actually, according to this research, about 14% were more likely to report treatment was moderate or excellent with Diclegis compared to placebo, which essentially says that it really works about the same as placebo for morning sickness.
The problem here is that this is a very highly charged atmosphere. This drug that you talk about that is licensed by the Food and Drug Administration actually is a reformulation. It used to be called Bendictine, which got removed from the market because of lawsuits. But then they found out it didn't actually cause any side effects. But the manufacturers pulled it off, and the Canadian company kind of brought a new product to the market a few years ago, which is basically the same product, but it is expensive. And here, the researchers, these researchers from Canada who, are questioning, is it at all effective? But there have been other studies. It's not just a single study of these meta-analyses, large studies of over 4,000 patients that do show it's maybe moderately effective. But are there other things we can do besides this drug?
Yeah, so there's certainly other things to start with. I think there's certainly you can try things like ginger. You can eat small, mm-hmm. frequent meals, things like that, that a lot of women, by the time they see their doctor have already started. So there's not too many things that we can offer as physicians for morning sickness that are as safe as Diclegis would be in pregnancy. The two medications within Diclegis alone are over the counter, but that Diclegis is the extended release formula of those medications, and a lot of women have a great success with it. It is a pretty expensive drug, however.
Yeah, I think you could certainly do ginger tea, certain positions to avoid that you can read about, certain smells that might irritate or bring on the nausea. Motions, because we do know that some of these same drugs work for motion sickness, and may work for here. And we're not telling people to stop the drug. We're saying to talk with your doctor because, what you might take could be worse than what could be effective. So talk with your doctor, but this is a good conversation. Let's go to our last research that matters really quickly. It's about a new drug that can reduce sickle cell pain crisis. These really bad from sickle cell disease, which affects over 80,000 people in the United States and one out of every 500 African-Americans. There's a new drug that actually sounds pretty good. It was actually helped produce or manufactured or tested at the University of North Carolina.
Yeah, so it's a new drug. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it, but it's SELG1.
Cell G1.
I like that. So it's actually not an opioid. It's an antibody that works against trying to prevent the vaso-occlusive crisis that happens with sickle cell patients. So essentially not an opioid, which is a good news because, as we know, opioids can be very addicting and oftentimes are not super effective in sickle cell crisis as well. So, this is a really great opportunity for, a lot of sickle cell patients to have a different type of medication to try to help them.
Yeah, it's an investigational, but I think it'll move to production hopefully in the very near future. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine, this research, important work. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Laura. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Rabbi Mark Borowitz, a recovering alcoholic and ex-con who now serves as a senior rabbi at Beit Tshuvah, about his story on faith and spirituality's role in recovery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. Today on Conversations, Laura, we're talking with Rabbi Mark Borowitz, a recovering alcoholic and ex-con who now serves as the senior rabbi and co-director of the Lane Breslow Institute at Beit Shuva about his story about faith and spirituality's role in recovery. Welcome to Your Health, Rabbi Borowitz.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so honored to be with you guys.
Well, we're so excited to have you on the show, and we know that you're going to be in the Durham Chapel Hill community, but our listeners across the country as well to be able to hear. And you really do have an incredible story. Tell us a little bit about yourself, which I guess is really about the book. So we should just say it. You've got an amazing book here, Holy Thief, The Holy Thief, which Publishers Weekly has called a heart-wrenching but hilarious story. We always ask our guests to tell us about themselves, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a nice Jewish boy who went really, really wrong. You know, this is, of course, retrospect that I'm telling the story. So for me, what happened was I was lost. I was lost, and I felt like I wasn't enough. There was something inherently wrong with me that other people didn't suffer from. And that way of looking at my life got me to continually see myself as bad, wrong, less than, etc. And from there, it was a very easy descent into addiction and criminality. I got enamored with crime after my father died because I was trying to help my mother take care of bills. You know, it was 1966, and she was making $80 a week gross. The house payment was $150, and there was three of us at home.
You had to make money, and you were pretty young.
Yeah, I mean, at least that's the story I told myself. See, Adam, what I've learned is that we tell ourselves stories, and because we don't talk about it with anybody else, we believe the stories we tell ourselves. And those lies that I was telling myself got me into more and more trouble. I mean, self-deception and the willingness to be deceived, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel says, are two major diseases of the human being. And so what happened was I told myself the story, and I had enough proof, in quotes, to make it true. And really, the truth is, I didn't feel like I fit in my own skin. I didn't feel like I belonged anyplace. And when my father died, the person who knew me best, who was my guy, was gone, and I was just adrift. So the question I asked myself was, how do I get out of feeling like this? And at that point, money and alcohol made perfect sense because it was the wrong question. Hmm. If I would have said, how do I go through this? How do I deal with these feelings? I would have sought and found a different solution. But instead, I was smarter, and so I came up with my own solution. And through that, I began a 20-year run with crime and alcoholism that took me to prison twice, jail numerous times, and that when I quit drinking, I was drinking a gallon of whiskey a day. So what happened was that I had a spiritual awakening when I went to prison in 1986, and I knew that God was trying to tell me something, and I had to sit here so I could figure it out.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that. And through your book and your story, it sounds like it was kind of an aha moment, and really it sounded like it was kind of overnight type thing. Is that kind of what happened, or is it more of a kind of gradual process?
It was an ecstatic experience. By that I mean that it was something that I wasn't thinking about. I don't know where those words came from. This is 30 years later, just so you understand. We're 30 years later. I still don't know how those words came into my being. But they were so profound that I knew they were true. And back growing up in the temple, been president of my USY group and stealing at the same time. That's how split I was and how deceptive I was to others. And of course, my mother and my family knew nothing about any of this while I was doing it. And what happened was that I had this amazing experience. And that's why I say it was an ecstatic experience, because I don't know where those words came from. And in that moment, I realized that I had to go back to learn something. So I went back to study Judaism. I studied it with the rabbi in prison, and I learned about tshuva. Now, tshuva in the Jewish tradition is repentance, translates as repentance, return, and response. In the 12-step movement, it's steps 4 through 9, actually 4 through 10. So really what it does is it gives me hope. It shows me a way to repair old behaviors, hope, and change. So when I learned about tshuva, I said, wow, there's hope. When I started to read the Torah, the Bible, I had already read something from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel that said I had to immerse myself in the text. So I was reading the third chapter of Genesis, actually right after I had gotten a letter from my then 6.5-year-old daughter. She wrote me a letter when I was in prison the second time, and she said, "Dear Daddy, I hate you. You're a part of me, and when you're in prison, a part of me is in prison. I didn't do anything to be in prison. Love, Heather." I wept that day openly in a prison cell, surrounded by a bunch of guys. And I started to immerse myself, and I was reading the third chapter of Genesis, where God says, "Ayeka, where are you?" And Adam says, "I'm hiding." And I wept again that day because I realized how often and how long I've been hiding from God, hiding from my daughter, hiding from everybody.
You say in your book that as an addict, the only thing you knew for certain is that you never knew, but yet here, your second time in prison, you're hearing a voice call out to you, and you kind of know for certain it's a voice of God. How did those two things seem like a little bit of a miracle, perhaps, but also, I guess, maybe totally unexpected?
I was shocked. And how do I know? I know because it came from deep inside of me. It came from this place that it came from my soul. It came from my kishkas, from my guts. And it was an experience of total certainty. I didn't question it. And it was a knowing. It wasn't a guessing. It wasn't a did I, didn't I. It was I know. I just knew it, I finally heard the message that God and everybody else have been trying to give me for a long time.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I think when we come back, I know Laura wants to talk about this turning movement, this teshuvah, this change, and also the origin of the title of the book, The Holy Thief. But we are going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Rabbi Mark Borowitz about his work as co-director of the Lane Breslow Institute and his book called The Holy Thief. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. We've been having a really inspiring, for at least for us, a conversation with Rabbi Mark Borowitz, and I'm sure for our listeners, a recovering alcoholic who was in prison, who became a senior rabbi and co-director of Beit Shuvah.
You're telling us a little bit about your story, about how, you know, you had this aha moment in prison and it kind of changed your life. And I was wondering if you could kind of speak to us a little bit more about your book, The Holy Thief, and how you came to become a rabbi, and, you know, all the work you're doing now.
Well, thank you. So how I became how I came to be a rabbi is a question that a lot of people have. And I have to tell you, I'm not sure. What happened was I was working at Beit Shuva, and I knew I had to go to graduate school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't feel like being a therapist. I really wanted to be a rabbi. I had gotten so into the Jewish tradition and understanding it differently. And I'm not your typical rabbi, I can say that. And
anything but.
I can echo that.
And what happened was the University of Judaism opened up the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies. And my wife, Harriet Rosetto, the founder of Beit Shuva, and my best friend, Rabbi Ed Feinstein, said to me on the same day, go apply. And I applied. And I went through the whole process. And I was accepted. And I went to school for 4 years straight. And I was ordained in 2000. So let me tell you a little story about what happened when I was on my way to work from staying with Ed on a Friday, and I decided to stop home. I don't know why I decided to stop home, but it was another one of those moments. So I stopped home, and I got the mail, and I saw there was an envelope from the University of Judaism. And I called Harriet, and I said, I got a letter. And she says, what's it say? I said, I don't know. She screamed at me, open it. I opened it, and all it said was Mazel Tov.
Which means?
And it said more. All I read was it Mazel Tov. And I said I got in, and she started screaming and crying, and I started screaming and crying. And then I called my brother and my mother and my sister and my daughter, and then I dialed this number in Cleveland, 371-3433. It was the number of my house growing up, because I was calling my father to tell him, I was calling my father to tell him the good news. My father at that point had been dead for 30 years. Mm. And I drove down to work, and everybody was standing there. Every resident of Beit Shuva was standing there. And I realized I didn't get into rabbinic school. We all got accepted. And that was a big turning point for me and for everybody else, that we were now the Jewish community of Los Angeles and the educational community had said people can change. We acknowledge that.
Well, you know, it's remarkable, and I know Rabbi Feinstein, in your book you talk about how the title of the book really came from when you got your ordination, and he talks about how you and the work you've done at Beit Shuva has rescued hundreds and hundreds of people. Tell us about Beit Shuva. What makes it unique? How does it like or not like other sorts of rehabilitation places that people may be more familiar with, like Alcoholics Anonymous?
What we do is we run an integrated program. So first of all, we're a Jewish faith-based, non-sectarian residential recovery center. So you know it's a little confusing already. And we integrate Judaism, 12 steps, psychotherapy, with the creative arts, with trauma therapy, and so much more. We run a program that meets people where they're at rather than us try and put them into a box. So our deal is that we build the box around people. And we everyone has a spiritual counselor, an addiction counselor, and a therapist. And those that need see psychiatrists. We have a huge family program. We have Torah study every morning. How Torah helps you to live better. It's not, you know, learning the halacha and all that, but it's really this: how does it help me live better? Because if I can't show you, if I can't see in a piece of Torah how it helps me live better or helps you live better, then I'm hiding.
So when you say Torah, you mean the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, and Halakha would be the laws of those books.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Thank you. I keep forgetting that. I start to get on a rant and then I forget stuff. Thank you. Right. So we have a career center. We have an intern externship program. We do everything we can to help somebody learn to live well. Living well is the mainstay of our program. And the other thing is that we take everybody, whether they can afford it or not. I mean, everybody that's appropriate and we have room for. Mm-hmm. But we don't. The first question is not what's your insurance or how much can you pay. The first question we ask is how can you help? And we've begun the Elaine Breslow Institute in order to train other professionals that are out there. Because a lot of people see addiction happening and they don't know. And even if they see it happening and think that they know, they don't know what to do. So we want to show them how to use text, how to use therapy, how to use everything at their disposal in order to intervene earlier, in order to help to prevent. And we believe that we can help people live well. And that everybody can. And really the whole deal is the training.
How many people do you think you've served thus far?
Overall?
Mm-hmm. Probably too many to count.
In our 30 years, tens of thousands.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Because, you know, we help families, we help people. Because we're also a synagogue, we help a lot of people just with spiritual sustenance.
What's the biggest challenge you face? I know both Laura and I take care of so many people who have so many difficult things, a lot of opioid problems. What's the biggest challenge you and Beit Shuva face?
Well, there's two of the biggest. One is financial. The model we have is one that depends on donations. So there's a financial aspect to it. The biggest challenge is infusing people with hope. People have had so much thrown at them that, why is this going to be different? Oh, I'll never get it. All of that kind of stuff. And people come here hopeless. So infusing them with hope and letting them know, most of all, that they matter. Everybody is important. And you know that, and I know that. But most people don't know that. They don't believe in the importance, in how important and how necessary they are. Rabbi Heschel calls every human a divine need and a divine reminder. And people forget that. They forget it and they don't believe it. And infusing that hope and strength back in them is the greatest challenge to continued sobriety.
Well, I think that's a message that can be left with our listeners and health professionals and patients and those struggling. Wonderful, wonderful message. Thank you, Rabbi Mark Baritz, the author of The Holy Thief, as well as Finding Recovery in Yourself and Torah, Daily Spiritual Path to Wholeness. We'll make links to both of these on our websites for our listeners who'd like to get a copy of these books, which I encourage. And if you have someone suffering, that this may be a tool and resource for them.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, if your listeners ever want to just talk to me, I'm here.
That's the hope.
They can always call.
That's the hope. That's amazing. And having read your book, I understand now why people seek you out. So thank you so much for being our guest on Your Health Today.
Thank you. Thank you all. God bless.
We've been talking with Rabbi Mark Baritz, Senior Rabbi and Co-Director of the Elaine Breslow Institute at Beit Shuva, about his story about faith and spirituality and recovery. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns as listeners. And if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, the other great Laura, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question today. Laura?
I'm moving to a new town, and I have to find a new doctor. One of my close friends actually practices in the town I'll be living in. Is it a good idea to go to a doctor you also know personally?
Well, this is one of those questions that's really interesting, and you're probably going to get, at least in some respects, four opinions if you ask three doctors. So maybe we'll give a couple of those opinions. What are your thoughts, Laura?
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. I think a lot of it really depends on the situation. You know, certainly in a small town where there aren't very many options for primary doctors in particular, you know, you might have to see your best friend that lives right next door. But in a setting where, you know, there's a lot of different physicians in the area, particularly in an area like Chapel Hill, I think probably it's better to have a doctor that you're not necessarily going to be sharing a drink with later on that evening. Oftentimes you can, especially if you have something that is, you know, maybe not something you want the entire world to know about. You don't really want to tell your doctor and then, you know, turn into a situation where you might have some ethical questions.
Yeah, I think that there's different ways of understanding this. In most communities, people like to know their doctor. So, you know, but what are the barriers there? And so I think it's important as a doctor to have barriers there. So, for instance, I might take care of some people in the community, and I might do most of their care, but maybe because of certain relationships, maybe I won't do their GYN care because of a relationship, how we might know each other socially or not. But I sometimes will say, you know, that's really up to you. I mean, I can take care and have taken care of people who I'm friends with. I might not be their best friend, but, you know, you're friendly with people, and you see people out in a community, so you're friends with them. Again, does that mean you won't go out to dinner with them as couples occasionally? No, I think that's probably, you know, really an individual circumstance. But the real key would be, to me, defining what the patient is comfortable with, what you're comfortable with, and doing that up front. Because, you know, we might actually give even better care at times to people we know because we're going to go overboard to make sure we don't give them worse care. You know, so the barriers or the assumptions could go both ways. Difficult question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
It seems like my Facebook feed is filling up with articles and posts about healthier cleaning products for your family. What do we really need to keep in mind when we buy cleaning supplies?
Well, I don't know about you, Laura, but I find that, for instance, if someone comes in and cleans my house and they are using lots of bleach products, I find it incredibly irritating. And I even have a hard time with some breathing. So I know that these things can be real irritating.
Yeah, particularly for people that, you know, have asthma already, certainly bleach can be a certainly irritant for them. The other thing is that if you are using cleaning products that have a lot of irritants, they can cause a lot of skin issues. Certainly making sure you're wearing gloves and things like that if you are using products that have chemicals in them. And the other thought is if you have asthma or are predisposed to having any kind of respiratory issues, making sure you're wearing a mask if you're going to be using a lot of the cleaning products that have bleach and ammonia in them.
Yeah, I had a patient who was cleaning up dormitories in a college, and they had actually developed occupational asthma as a result of exposure. So we know that these can be a problem. I guess in terms of some of the things that could be used other than these elements, I know baking soda is a frequent natural cleanser that people use lots of times to help clean up stovetops and other things. Lemon. Very natural antibacterial effects. Some people use vinegar. I don't know if everyone's heard their mother or their grandmother. At least that's what I heard. Cornstarch. I even mentioned borax in some products. And borax is this white powder that can be an irritant, but frequently it's considered similar to baking soda and kind of salt. So, you know, nothing probably doesn't affect everyone, but some things probably affect people a lot more. So I'm all for trying to do as much natural as you can in this particular circumstance. If it works and you like it and it doesn't affect you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My sister-in-law is pregnant and is considering a home birth. My brother doesn't like the idea. What are the risks of home birth and can it be safe?
Well, this is probably another, what would we call it, like our research that matters earlier, Laura, where we said we were talking about drugs in the pregnancy. This is another question that people have strong opinions about, And maybe we can focus in on some of the data. I know you do prenatal care and delivering babies. I did it for a very long time. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think, home birth is something that's people are talking about a lot. A lot of my patients ask me that question as well. I think, for somebody that has really, really low risk and feels comfortable and understands the risk of having a delivery at home, it can be a very beautiful thing. I think the most important thing is that you have somebody that is there with you, that is licensed, and particularly, making sure if they are a midwife, it's a certified nurse midwife and has had that training to be there with you in case something does go wrong, that you can get to the hospital very quickly and that you have somebody by your side that knows what they're doing in those emergency situations.
Yeah, I think those are really important points there, that the people who tend to use a home midwife tend to be a little bit older. They tend to be Caucasian. They may have had another child before. They want a low intervention birth. And they want to be in charge of the process, and they maybe are dissatisfied with hospital care, or maybe they think it could be that this is better for them. But the guidelines would suggest actually that in some circumstances for these planned out-of-hospital birth in low-risk women in developed countries might have reduced C-sections, might have reduced lacerations and medical interventions and similar morbidity, mortality, the bad things than if you're having it in the hospital. Of course, these are different types of women. These are low-risk women. And so if you give your consent, you've got a baby that's at term, it's pointing a downward, it's a single baby, you really don't have any serious maternal issues, no contraindications to vaginal birth, and you've got, as you said, someone really qualified with backup, perfectly fine.
Yeah, I agree. Just making sure you know when to move if you need to move.
Yes, like if you're a couple hundred miles away,
yeah, yes.
you better have some backup plans there. But then
Absolutely.
Again, if you're a couple hundred miles away, you might need to have that in any case.
Yeah.
Ms. Laura, what is our last house call?
My teenage son has a 10-minute morning routine to get out the door, which means he frequently leaves the house with wet hair. Can walking around with wet hair in the cold really make you sick?
Well, is 10 minutes fast or slow, Laura? what do we think here? Is this like, because when I first heard this, I thought, oh, it takes him that long to get out the door. And I think you were thinking that, oh, this is something really kind of quick.
Well, my husband takes about 20 minutes. So 10 minutes is doing pretty well, I think.
I think that the teenager, well, it depends. We have to define when the teenage boy or the girl is actually awake. Because, right, the wake part may not come till 10 minutes after the alarm clock or 20 minutes. I don't know. Is exposure to cold going to cause a problem or not with wet hair? Probably not. I haven't seen research on this particular, and I'm not sure anyone will do research on this particular question. But what do you think?
Well, I think, the thing we do know is that it doesn't give you a cold. It's not going to cause the virus to transmit to you just with having cold hair. But certainly it might make you feel pretty chilly.
Yeah, I think that the routine in the morning, probably 10 minutes is pretty good then here in this particular circumstance. To get it to change that routine to 15 minutes, I remember I used to like turn the heater on in the car, though. I'd get in that car, but the heater, you turn the heater on and kind of get that blow dryer effect from the, full up to number 10 on the vents there. That's another solution there. Everyone else get a little hot in the car, but it could work.
That's right.
So, well, thank you so much for your house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for listening to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. And you can share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app by searching Your Health for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Rabbi Mark Borowitz. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Laura Gay.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.